Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. The sound of mining and the sound of money. All across Griqualand West, tent towns mushroomed overnight, teeming with fortune seekers from around the world. Tens of thousands by 1873, all descending on a patch of dusty ground that was soon to become a beacon of development on the landscape. In the modern world, industrial diamonds have hammered the industry business model. China overwhelmingly dominates global production in synthetic industrial diamonds. They account for over 90% of the total. But in the 19th century, diamonds were still as rare as a teetotaler in a Kimberley tavern. This episode, we'll hear about the entrepreneurs, both black and white, and the future robber baron and colonial dreamer, Cecil John Rhodes. It was in May 1871, after the harvest at the Rhodes Brothers Cotton Farm in Richmond in Natal, that Rhodes began his long career of harvesting the right connections. Brother Herbert sailed to Natal 2 years earlier, and now Cecil was helping manage the 250-acre farm, helped by 30 black labourers. Herbert, however, had heard about the riches discovered in Griqualand West and headed off to the diamond fields in early 1871, leaving Cecil to run the show in Natal. Young Cecil attended the annual meeting of the colony's agricultural society, where he exhibited samples of cotton. In attendance were Natal's colonial elite. There were long after-dinner political speeches, all ending with a toast. In the haze of tobacco smoke and a haze of multiple shots of whiskey, one settler called for a man to offer the traditional toast to the ladies. It was ironic then that Cecil Rhodes rose in response and thus delivered his first ever public speech, according to his friend and biographer, Lewis Mitchell. Ironic because Rhodes would never form an intimate relationship with a woman, as far as we know. As he grew more powerful, he would always surround himself with young male private secretaries and would later make one, Neville Pickering, the sole beneficiary of his will. In the Victorian era, being openly homosexual was socially unacceptable and illegal, so any such relationships would have been kept private. We are hampered by a lack of personal diaries or revealing letters from Rhodes himself, making it difficult to reach a firm, irrefutable conclusion about his private life. Rhodes famously said he had too much work on his hands to be a dutiful husband and busy he was going to be. Shortly after his To the Ladies speech, on September 1st, spring day, 1871, the Diamond Fields newspaper reported that one Herbert Rhodes had found a total of 110 carats of diamonds. Cecil quickly bought a bucket and a spade, and instead of heading east to the beach, he headed west, left Natal in October for a month-long journey to the Diamond Fields in a Scotch cart pulled by oxen. Destination Colesberg Kopje to join Herbert, the hill that was yielding diamonds at Vooruitzicht. Accompanying the young man, several works of the classical authors and a Greek dictionary. Perfect for a sunny day in Africa. He was planning to study at Oxford, and the entry exam included Greek. The ox cart lumbered over the northern slopes of the Drakensberg, then southwest to Bloemfontein, and onwards to Griqualand West. What happened on this journey was significant, for as the wagon jolted along, the felt opened up the vastness of the landscape, and that triggered something deep in his consciousness. His view expanded with the felt as he travelled, and he would later say, South Africa's interior landscape is one of the great unconfined spaces of the world. From then onwards, Rhodes developed what his biographer calls that clear, direct gaze characteristic of those who have dwelt long in those sun-washed spaces, a gaze that seemed to be straining out to a far distant horizon and never finding the goal of his visions. He would be joined by other dreamers of all races and cultures, around 400 arriving a day, a seething, churning mass of humanity, all straining their gaze out to a far distant horizon, and most never finding the goals of their visions. Rhodes was in it to win it. He wanted, like all middle-class Victorian Englishmen, to turn a profit. Soon he was in the thick of it, red sand at the top, black and white stony shale below. Inside this was the diamondiferous soil, as he wrote to his mother. They have been able to find no bottom yet, and keep on finding steadily at 70 feet. The big hole was growing by the minute. The treasure hunters were pulling out a big diamond per 50 buckets of the soil, dust pouring into the sky, covering the men. Reverend Kwai Chamzashi said later it was difficult to distinguish between black and white diggers because all were covered in this diamondiferous soil. Chamzashi was a Wesleyan missionary, born in Beaufort West. His father was the head counselor to Chief Sandile of the Amaxhosa. He would give his name to one of Kimberley's black locations called Gwai. So here they all were, chopping into the earth, first leveling, then creating a basin, then a hole. Kimberley Mine, the big hole. Herbert was bitten by the exploration bug, and his younger brother caught the disease. Cecil was pulling in around £100 a week working for Herbert, and with the cash, he bought a claim of his own. The small-scale claim owners did much of their own manual labour, but for the most part, the work was done by black labourers, picking at the ground, smashing the bumps of earth and rock, sieving the lime dust through a coarse wire sieve, rubble thrown aside, what remained in place then put on a sorting table. A small scraper would be used to spread the rock on these tables, scooping after the diamonds. Repeat, repeat. Until 1872, there were many black claim owners, but this was going to change as the competition grew fierce. White owners would oversee the operations, migrants from the Cape Colony, of other mining regions of Britain, Australia and the US West. They were all there. The diamond diggers borrowed from the three-tiered system that had worked so well at the copper mines of O'Keeppe, I mentioned in episode 222. Herbert was far more outgoing than Cecil, a natural wit with social polish lacking in his younger brother, who was not naturally charismatic. The sprawling mining camps emerged around Colesberg Kopje and the De Beers farm mine. The brothers began to build a tight-knit social circle, a group of upper-middle-class Englishmen and some colonials, who called themselves the 12 Apostles. These were to become Cecil's lifelong friends and business connections, including someone we're going to hear a great deal about, John X. Merriman, member of the Cape Parliament since 1869. When the House of Assembly was out of session, John X. Merriman was in Kimberley, representing a diamond-buying syndicate. Like politicians the world over, conflicted, mixing business and politics, like brandy and coke, whiskey and soda, or gin and tonic. Rhodes was going to get insider information from Merriman about economic development and infrastructure planning. Having the right connections and trusted intelligence, making informed bets on the future, that's business. The 12 Apostles included John Blades Curry, soon to become Colonial Secretary of Griqualand West, as well as Charles Dunnell Rudd, ex-Harrow and Cambridge athlete, and Rhodes' future business partner, Sidney Shippard, Oxford graduate and future colonial administrator of South Africa, and future judge Jacob Barry. During the day, Rhodes sat amongst black workers, in the blinding sun passing the sifted diamonds before his dazzled eyes, as his biographer wrote, and later as impressionist painter Norman Garston wrote. As tailing began piling up behind them, often Rhodes, his tall, delicate figure crumpled up on an inverted bucket as he sat scraping the gravel surrounded by his dusky Zulus. In early 1872, Herbert went back to their farm in Richmond to welcome yet another brother, Frank Rhodes, to South Africa. Cecil was left in charge and then began to suffer under the stress of the hard labour in a harsh climate, supervising his business, and then the sudden death of his close friend, John Thompson. He was smoking and drinking too much, breathing in too much dust, dehydrated. He collapsed to be nursed back to health by John Blades Curry's wife, Mary. He was still only 18 years old and almost died. In his miasmic state, he wrote his will, which is prescient and somewhat theatrical, leaving all his possessions at that stage to Britain's Secretary of State for the Colonies, Lord Kimberley, instead of his family. Rhodes was thinking about his legacy even then, as a callow youth, lying on a dusty bed in the blazing heat of Griqualand West, sweating a fever, hallucinating about his death. Mortality and empire building, the twin sense of identity. This was further reinforced when Herbert returned and Cecil suggested they trek northward from the diamond diggings, leaving third brother Frank in charge. This trip lasted 8 months. Some suggest it was more like four, we're not sure. Whichever is the correct, it is the journey that is important. They rode 250 kilometres to Vryburg, then 180 to Mafeking, 250 kilometres to Marabastad to the east near Pretoria, aiming to investigate reports of gold discovered nearby. They found no gold, but on their way home they stopped at a large farm in the side of a big ridge called Roodepoort. A large 3,000-acre farm. Rhodes liked it so much he bought it. In a few years, a powerful city would develop nearby called Johannesburg, and the Roodepoort would become a suburb of that city. Rhodes bought Roodepoort. Why, we're not sure. Later, in a letter to Natal Surveyor General Peter Sutherland, he would describe Roodepoort as of no earthly good and only sunk money, which many in the suburb today would describe as either acrid or insulting, depending on the state of the electricity, water and sewage services. Frank, meanwhile, was monitoring growing anger amongst the diggers. Sir Henry Barclay had received a memorandum from white diggers who said that the theft of diamonds had become untenable and that all claims by black owners should be banned. They said it was a cover for the illegal sale of these gems and that it was causing poverty and destitution amongst the unlucky. By unlucky, they meant the unlucky white people. Barclay said it was unnecessary to prohibit blacks from holding mining licenses, but radicals like Augustus Frederick Lindley, in his anti-black speeches, declared otherwise. If this continued, he said, it would be almost impossible for white men to compete with natives as diggers. The blacks could operate with less capital. They walk everywhere and don't need transport, he said. And then, of course, as with all these sorts of people, Lindley railed, not to argue further upon a truism, the difference between the general wants, necessities, character and position of the two races, utterly forbid it. This kind of rampant spittle-laden poison was going to mar the relationship between races for a long, long time hence. Not all white diggers agreed with this, but they were shoved aside in the growing vehemence of the narrative. New promulgations were thus passed by the miners themselves. Black people could not stay in the mining camps for longer than 2 days without a master. They also had to observe a curfew after 9 p.m. Punishment for failing to observe these rules, 25 lashes or a 10 shillings fine. All this at a time when most of the English-speaking world was repealing lashing. Blacks found with diamonds in their possession would be given 50 lashes, and whites who bought stones from blacks and could not account for their origin would be given up to 50 lashes too. Their property would be seized, and they, if they survived this, would be expelled from the diggings forever. 50 lashes, just by the way, is potentially lethal, according to author William H. Warger, writing in his book South Africa's City of Diamonds, Mine Workers and Monopoly Capitalism in Kimberley, 1867 to 1895. Colonial staff deemed these regulations monstrous. Colonial Secretary at this time, in 1872, was Richard Southey, and he advised Barclay that they had to calm the white diggers down. Barclay duly signed Proclamation No. 8 of 1872, which said that anyone dealing in diamonds needed a license. The start of diamond licensing. What was going on would become De Beer's preferred method of dealing in diamonds, form a monopoly, ensure that the authorities support extreme punishment for breaking the somewhat unscrupulous law. Unrest continued. Diggers like Alfred Aylward demanded a new government office set up called Native Search Office, where blacks would be physically patted down and whatever else, then issued a certificate of search. Black people would need passes to get in and out of the camps. By mid-July 1872, as Rhodes and his brother were eyeing Roodepoort, white diggers burned down tents they said were owned by illicit diamond dealers. The British suspended mining licenses then of 46 black prospectors at Tutoi Span and Bultfontein. Barclay signed another notice, number 68, forcing all black people to get a pass before they could enter the diggings to seek employment. The overtones of history barking at us through these methods. Methods that would be honed to perfection in the 20th century. But as we all know, it's one thing to pass a law, totally another to enforce it. At the end of July 1872, the Natal Witness was reporting that natives at Bultfontein are digging under license, despite the attempt at removing their licenses. While the newspaper bleated about illicit dealings, blaming blacks, an Afrikaans digger called Tienus Berry was sentenced to 7 years in prison for stealing diamonds worth £8,000. In August 1872, Proclamation 14 was signed by Governor Barclay, which allowed white diggers to conduct citizens' arrests on what were called servants and take them to magistrates. As Pakamisa Nzamela has pointed out in his book Native Merchants, Barclay's proclamation was more about class legislation than purely race. It doesn't mention color. However, its teeth were, in his words, sharpened to bite at black people. The black diggers didn't sit back taking all of this. On September 6th, Sir Henry Barclay met with disgruntled black diggers at Skaldstam, a couple of hours' ride away from Detroit's Spun, Diamond Fields and Kimberley. 60 black claim holders rode up in 10 carts and wagons, along with a brass band playing God Save the Queen and carrying a banner titled Long Live the Governor and Liberty to All. 3 days later, Barclay met 13 members of the Committee of Coloured Diggers Association, who represented 400 Americans as well as locals, what they called respectable coloured diggers. They said to Barclay they were indeed sticky-fingered natives, as they put it, but that this didn't form a class of people because there were also sticky-fingered whites. Big money was being made and many were feeding the cash back to their communities, setting in motion the next phase of rural development. By the end of 1872, there were around 50,000 people living in the place that was soon going to be named Kimberley. 13,000 of those were classified as Cape or Natal colonials or from the Transvaal and the Free State. The rest were immigrants. About 8,000 of those were black people from South Africa other than the colonies, the bulk from the northwestern Transvaal, the Bapedi people, and the Amandebele. 400 black workers left the diamond diggings every day, carrying new wealth back to their villages. Farmers of all races were earning a killing selling food and other commodities into the diamond mining territories. What was called the New Rush had led to a vast sum of around £30,000 paid in total to black workers in 1872. That cash was being converted into blankets and horses and oxen, cattle, wagons, ploughs, and of course, guns. Despite the white diggers' attempts, blacks continued to own and mine claims. For example, the register of diggings around Bultfontein in 1874 showed that there were 129 black owners out of a total of 135 registered. Amazing, really. They were classified as merchants and diggers first, not black. Many from the British colonies, the Cape, Natal, the Amamfengu, Amanxika, Cape Coloureds, AmaZulu, Indians from Natal, and Christian-educated Africans from Griqua and West itself. A growing class of people from all ethnic backgrounds. There were blacksmiths and mechanics, masons, carpenters, barmen, cart drivers, clerks, coachmen, wheelwrights, and many were the women who sewed and ironed and washed and baked, and these would become permanent residents of the new town of Kimberley. The outlook for these people of all kinds was truly extraordinary. Meanwhile, Rhodes had arrived back from his national walkabout and had to make a decision. Should he return to England and resume his studies or stay here and mine diamonds? It was a yes about returning to England, and he returned to the UK for a year, passed his entrance exam to study law, but after a few months, the vast opportunities of South Africa's horizons beckoned him back to the diamond fields. He would only complete his law degree on a part-time basis in 1883. Back in the diamondiferous frontier, the budding imperialist was expanding his network of associates, including Charles Dunnell Rudd, who I mentioned earlier. Rudd was 9 years older than Rhodes and became his long-term associate. Like Rhodes, Rudd had left college mid-degree, apparently straining his heart while overtraining to try and beat the four-minute mile, and so he needed to come to South Africa and restore his health. Rudd's travels had included Mauritius, always good for the heart, yes, Sri Lanka, and months riding around South Africa. You know how everything ties up, because his main guide for much of his time in Natal on this ride was none other than John Dunn Esquire, British trader and full-time Zulu chief, a close ally of Cetshwayo Kampande. It was Rudd who showed Rhodes the capitalist chops, mentoring him in the ways of business, how to be versatile, adaptive and quick. Rhodes learnt this first working as Rudd's clerk and soon deployed Rudd's business nous when prices at the mine dipped. He and Rudd bought what was known as the old mine called De Beers. The early diamond rush had been lucrative, coming at a time of global growth. It was after the American Civil War ended in 1865, and then the opening of the Suez Canal in 1867, the unification of Germany in 1871, which had fueled an economic boom for luxury goods. While South Africa's economy had taken a bit of a bad turn earlier in the 60s, railway speculator growth, agricultural developments, and modern shipping had led to great optimism around the world. In May 1873, a panic on the Vienna Stock Exchange caused a downward spiral in share prices worldwide, leading to labor unrest. and famous bankruptcies like Jay Cook's Northern Pacific Railroad. This depression would last to 1879, but in Griqualand West, Rhodes and his partners adopted a brilliant tactic, the mantra of all respectable capitalists. When there's blood on the streets, buy property. Thus we end this episode. Next week we'll swing around the Southern African region, taking in the updates from the early 1870s. Infrastructure was improving, roads and railway lines being built, port facilities upgraded. Just before going, a big thank you to Peter and the Maritime Lawyers Association of South Africa for inviting me to chat at their annual convention in Durban. It was really, really interesting. Please rate the podcast on your favorite platforms. That helps elevate its visibility, and you can head off to desmondlatham.blog, where I'm loading updates about various episodes. You can email me from there. Until next, goodbye.